piece on the court Zoom oral argument calendar this morning, the state of Minnesota versus Tony Elizabeth, is it Ickler or Eichler?
Your Honor, it's Eichler.
Eichler. The case number is A220079. We are ready for arguments from counsel for Ms. Eichler. Would you introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your argument?
Yes, Your Honor. Good morning. May it please the court, and counsel. I'm Adam Lozo, and I represent the appellant, Tony Eichler. This appeal raises three distinct issues, and I'm happy to answer questions the court has about any of the three issues at this time. I'll start by discussing why the evidence introduced at trial was insufficient to prove that there was an HRO in effect on the day of the alleged violations. The HRO that was allegedly violated was a temporary ex parte HRO issued by a referee. The HRO statute provides that a referee may issue a temporary ex parte order like this one, but also provides that such a temporary order is in effect only, quote, until a hearing is held on the issuance of a restraining order, end quote. The state's Exhibit 2, entered at the trial, shows that a hearing was indeed held on the issuance of the restraining on the issuance of a restraining order, and that no order was issued after that hearing by the judge who presided over the hearing. Because a temporary ex parte HRO is in effect only until the HRO hearing is held, the state's evidence, which was a copy of the temporary ex parte HRO and of the register of actions in that case, was insufficient to show that there was an HRO in effect more than a week after the HRO hearing was held on the date of the alleged violations.
So just to be clear, counsel, your argument is that as of August 19, 2020, the temporary HRO was ineffective as an operational statute.
Correct, Your Honor.
Okay.
That's yes, that's correct. And that is what the language of the statute provides. So I'm happy to continue to answer any questions about that particular issue, or I'll turn to the second issue, which is that Ms. Eichler's conviction must be reversed because she received ineffective assistance of counsel when her trial attorney misread a call record for Eichler's mother's phone and failed to notice that he had the call record for Eichler's phone, resulting in him failing to use that exculpatory evidence at trial. Now, those call records, as produced at the evidentiary hearing, do not reflect that the phones the state accused Ms. Eichler of using to make these phone calls actually made those calls. Because counsel misread one of those two sets of records and failed to even notice that he had the other set of records, which are both findings that the post-conviction court made about what happened here, that evidence, that exculpatory evidence, was not introduced at trial. And I think it's important to point out also that the post-conviction court found in its order that this evidence, had it been introduced at trial, would have established reasonable doubt about what occurred here. I think those two sets of findings and conclusions by the district court in conjunction show that both Strickland prongs are met. The district court found deficient performance and stated in its order that introduction of the call records would have established reasonable doubt. I think that when those two things are put together, that both Strickland prongs are fulfilled, and Ms. Eichler's convictions must be reversed for that reason as well.
Mr. Lozo, so I appreciate your quoting all relevant words there. Reasonable doubt about what occurred. Seems to me that's a little bit vague, or at least it doesn't. You know, the post-conviction court did not say reasonable doubt about whether she's guilty or reasonable doubt about whether she placed the calls. I mean, how should we interpret that phrase, reasonable doubt about what occurred?
Well, I think two answers to that, Your Honor. First, I think by using the phrase reasonable doubt, all of us here know that that is a phrase that it refers to the standard of proof in a criminal trial. So I think that using those terms, that term in particular, reasonable doubt, shows that the district court was referring to whether the jury would have reached the same decision. And I do think that it's also that even setting that aside, that if there's reasonable doubt about what happened, I think that equates to reasonable doubt to whether the state proved its case, because the state's case, as asserted and as developed at trial, was that was alleging that Ms. Eichler used her mother's phone and used her phone to make these calls. The prosecutor, of course, emphasized repeatedly at trial that one reason the jurors should find that that this case was proven was because these calls supposedly came from phones that were that the alleged victim knew to be associated with Ms. Eichler and via her mother with Ms. Eichler in that way. If there's reasonable doubt as to whether that's true, that undermines the entirety of the state's case. And so even if that phrase by the district court is not interpreted as directly referring to the verdict, which I think it should, given the use of the phrase reasonable doubt, I think that if there's reasonable doubt as to what occurred, there's reasonable doubt as to the state's theory of guilt entirely. So I welcome and I'm happy to answer any questions on either of those two issues. And I'll start now discussing the third issue and overviewing that as well. The third issue is that Ms. Eichler's convictions must be reversed because the court plainly erred by admitting inadmissible and prejudicial hearsay statements on the first page of the first exhibit that was presented to the jury. Those statements describe judicial findings regarding a variety of prior bad acts that the referee said that she found that Ms. Eichler engaged in. Those statements were inadmissible hearsay. They shouldn't have been admitted at the trial, and they were prejudicial to Ms. Eichler, and for all the reasons described in the brief. And I'm happy to discuss any of these further issues in detail. If the court does not have further questions at this time, I will cede my time, but I'm happy to answer any questions that the court has. Otherwise, I also do think that the briefing is adequate is more than adequate to conclude that Ms. Eichler's convictions should be reversed and that the case should be remanded for a new trial if the relief is granted on issue 2 or 3, or if relief is granted, as I believe it should be on issue 1, judgment of acquittal entered. Thank you.
All right, I don't see any other questions, so we'll now hear from counsel for the state. Would you introduce yourself for the record before proceeding with your argument?
Support, counsel. I'm Jim Haas. I'm an assistant Olmsted County attorney, and I represent the state of Minnesota in this case. Maybe I'd like to start off with this issue of the ineffective assistance of counsel. That was the focus of the post-conviction proceeding.
Actually, counsel, can we talk about the statute? Because if there wasn't an HRO in effect, then we're not remanding. So tell me why 609.748 subdivision 4 does not control to end this case. I mean, once the district court has a hearing on August 19, 2020 on the harassment restraining order, doesn't the statute render the earlier temporary order ineffective?
No, it does not, because that is not what the statute says. I think we have to look at the plain language. I just want to turn to that temporary in my brief.
The temporary restraining order is in effect until a hearing is held.
Yes, that's true. And once the hearing is held, we look to the record of the hearing to determine what the district court does at that proceeding.
Say that in the statute? The statute doesn't make reference to some subsequent action by the district court. It only references the holding of a hearing, right?
It does, but the statute does not say what counsel urges the court to fill in the blank is that the order lapses. That would be, as I've argued in my brief, nonsensical.
Why doesn't it? In effect until a hearing is held. Is it in effect until some different time?
Well, I think the facts in this case are illustrative. The court is unwilling to look at the record of this proceeding, and I've argued about it in my brief. Maybe I'm a little hamstrung, but in this case, I guess to try to answer the court's question, Ms. Eichler waived a hearing on it and accepted the order.
I just ask it a different way?
Yeah.
So if the temporary order is in effect until a different time other than when the hearing is held, what time would that be? How long is it in effect?
It's in effect until a district court judge vacates the order.
And where does it say that in the statute?
Well, It doesn't say that any more than it says the order lapses upon the commencement of the hearing. If we were to interpret that, we could have a hearing and the order commences, and at that point, the protected party is unprotected. That can't possibly be what the legislature intends. It gets us, as I've argued in my brief, what I think the point is that just because a petitioner requests a hearing, that action does not cause the ex parte temporary order to be ineffective. That doesn't cause it to lapse. And I think that's what the legislature is trying to say. Hey, just because someone challenges this ex parte hearing or this ex parte temporary restraining order doesn't mean it's not in effect anymore. It stays in effect, and it's going to stay in effect until you can come before a district court judge. And then it's up to the court. Then it's up to the district court to decide.
Counsel, could you clarify for me, because maybe I'm not understanding the record, but my indication was we have a temporary ex parte restraining order against Ms. Eichler. Ms. Eichler requested a hearing on the temporary order. There was a hearing, and then no HRO issued after the hearing. Is that correct? Okay.
Yes and no. I disagree. I think there was an order issued. It was ordered on the record. And of course, Judge Chase ordered Eichler's attorney to submit a proposed order, and Eichler's attorney never did. That's the underlying record, as we cited in the brief.
And why would Ms. Eichler's attorney submit an order that works against her client? Shouldn't the state submit a draft order? Why didn't the state submit a draft order?
Well, I suspect it's because Ms. Eichler, if you read the transcript of the hearing, she didn't want to have a full-blown evidentiary hearing where a district court judge makes factual findings about her misconduct. Ms. Eichler is willing to say, fine, I'm willing to not contest this HRO. Fine. I just don't want a judge to make factual findings.
All right.
Why
don't we have the district court has at its option many form orders, and we routinely see form orders in this type of proceeding. And one of the boxes on the form order that applies to this type of proceeding says the respondent denies having engaged in harassment, other behavior, but does not object to the entry of an HRO. So the judge issues the HRO. Why do we have no order? And if we don't have an order, doesn't the state have to live with that? I mean, at the end of the day, you've got to show that there was an order.
Well, again, I think we have to look to the record of the hearing, which I've asked the court to do and have cited to the transcript, which is public record. And the parties came before the court. Ms. Eichler was the one seeking the hearing. And she says, you know what? I no longer want a hearing. I'm willing to just live with the temporary restraining order.
And the court said, I'm going to issue an HRO, but didn't reduce that order to writing.
Right. The order commemorates what the judge orders, but the judge's order on the record is effective. And the judge said that temporary restraining order that was in effect continues to be in effect. It does not lapse. And he looked Ms. Eichler, I suppose, in the eye and said, do you get that? She says, I understand that. That's the order. That's appealable. That is an order of the court. The subsequent written order merely commemorates what the judge ordered. It's helpful to have something in the record such that a transcript may not be required. But I submit that the district court's order has that full force and effect. And Judge Chase simply said, look, that order remains in effect. And Ms. Eichler says, yeah, I agree.
So your argument is we have an order. It was an oral order stated on the record. It doesn't matter that it wasn't reduced to writing. It was an oral statement that I'm going to grant the order. The temporary remains in effect until I sign the HRO.
Yes.
Okay.
And Ms. Haas, I'm sorry.
I'm just going to raise this because then perhaps opposing counsel can address it. I'm thinking of case law in which a judge says one thing at sentencing and then the written order that results is different. And I believe what our case law says in that instance, the written or the oral statements on the record control because the defendant was present. That's what the defendant heard. So that's binding on the defendant, not what later comes out in writing. So I wonder if that case law applies here or by analogy.
I agree.
Mr. Haas, I want to clarify that the transcript of the hearing in the other case, the civil HRO case, wait, was that transcript offered into evidence at the criminal trial?
No, Your Honor.
Can you say it again? I just didn't hear you well.
No.
Okay, the answer is no. And at the criminal trial, I mean, the prosecutor, offered, exhibit one, I believe, is the THRO. And I haven't reviewed the closing argument, but I'm guessing that the prosecutor argued to the jury that the HRO that was violated by the defendant is the THRO that's exhibit one. Am I correct about that?
During this.
Okay. I'm not sure if others are having a hard time hearing Mr. Haas as well as me, but you're muted, Judge Larkin.
And as well, yes.
Okay. It's just your microphone might be, it's faint. It's still, I can hear a little bit, but it's faint and it cuts out a little bit. But
it's cutting out on my end too. So perhaps, well, never mind.
Can you hear me better now?
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay. I unhooked my headphones. I think the microphone in this might be not so great. That's better?
And am I correct? I mean, Mr. Haas, that it's general principles is that an HRO, when it's issued by the court, must be served upon the respondent in the matter in order to be effective with respect to that respondent, correct?
Correct. And this order was served, and that's in the record in the trial exhibits.
The THRO was served, but was there service of any document that could possibly be an HRO after the August 19 hearing?
No. The testimony and the exhibits at trial show that the temporary restraining order was personally served on Ms. Eichler. We have testimony to that effect, along with the certificate of service of that. But there were no, to my knowledge, any subsequent written orders following the temporary restraining order.
Thank you.
So, counsel, then, as I understand it, although the district court may have said at the hearing on the TRO, the TRO is going to remain in effect, I'm ordering an HRO, I'm ordering Ms. Eichler's counsel to prepare that for the court, none of that evidence was presented to the jury at the criminal trial. Is that correct?
That's correct. The register of action was provided. And as I argued, there is nothing in the register of action.
What did the register of action show? Did it say HRO issued?
I'll pull it up. It's exhibit two of the trial exhibits. And it simply, it's the standard register of actions in the civil file. It shows the harassment restraining order issued on April 30th, 2020. And it indicates that a harassment hearing was held at 2:30 p.m. before Judge Chase, says held on the record. It indicates it was by remote technology, but
it says result held on the record. So it doesn't say that the result of the hearing was that an order was issued, right?
Let's see. It says result held on the record, but there's nothing in the register of action to indicate that the THRO was vacated. You know, effectively, upon appeal, as I've argued, this is a collateral attack on the order to which there was no objection raised at trial.
Counsel, I'm having a hard time understanding why the TRO remained in effect. I mean, the way this works, based on my experience in district court, is there's a TRO, it's ex parte. You know, the judge is assuming everything's correct. If somebody says, no, I want a hearing, that's not correct, we have a hearing. And the purpose of that hearing is to make sure there's a basis for an HRO. And so we have that here, but we don't actually have proof of the HRO going to the jury in the criminal case. So I don't understand what proof, if your theory is she violated the temporary order, what proof did the jury have that the temporary order was still in effect when we have a statute that says it remains in effect only until you have a hearing? seems to me that the way this is written, the judge needs to issue an order that day, which is normally what happens. And that's why we have the use of these forms. I've never seen a case in my many, many years as I get up there where we have a TRO, a hearing, and we don't have an immediate order resulting from that hearing.
Well, let me give a different factual scenario. Let's say we show up at this hearing and the protected party, CJ, says, you know what, Judge, Tony and I have reconciled. I no longer want a TRO in effect. In fact, I would like you to vacate that order. And the judge says, great, consider it done. The order is hereby vacated. And since CJ is the one asking for it, tell you what, I'm on vacation next week, but send a proposed order to my chambers and I'll sign that. That'd be great. So the order is hereby vacated. You two can go and do your thing. And of course, they're seen by an officer who knows them 2 hours later, and he charges the defendant with the HRO violation. Is it irrelevant that Judge Chase said on the record, the order is hereby vacated? I think not. Now, obviously, I don't think we would prosecute somebody for that, but I think the same applies here. Judge Chase said that order has not lapsed. It remains in full force and effect. And that statement on the record is effective. The statute doesn't prohibit
that. I tend to agree that the statement's effective, but then the issue becomes, what proof of that order was provided to the jury in the criminal case? So the jury didn't have that transcript to say the TRO remains in effect.
Because we look at the evidence in the light most favorable to the verdict. And that's the evidence we should be looking at. The problem with this entire argument is that it's not a sufficiency argument. It's a collateral attack on a legal basis that was not raised in the district court.
I don't understand that argument. She was charged with violation of a harassment restraining order.
Yep. And the issue is,
was there a harassment restraining order on the day she allegedly violated? You have to prove that there was one. No one's saying you have to prove it was valid. You just have to prove it exists. And I'm asking you, what was your best proof that it existed on that day of the alleged violation?
Because the TRO was admitted without objection. The register of action was admitted without objection, and it does not show that it was vacated. And it was testimony of two witnesses, the deputy that arrested Eichler that said, I checked, and that order was still in effect, as well as CJ, the protected party, who said, yeah, the order is still active. So there's proof and testimony that the jury believed. And we have to assume that the jury believed the order. We have to assume the jury believed the register of actions, and we have to assume they believed the testimony. At least we look at it in the light most favorable to the verdict. We're now being asked on appeal to prove a negative. Understood. Prove it didn't exist. That's the unfair argument here. I think I proved with at least the transcript, if the court's willing to consider it, that it was in full force and effect, and Ms. Eichler knew it.
Okay,
but we're being asked now.
How would we consider the transcript if the transcript wasn't admitted at the criminal trial? We can't base our decision on evidence that wasn't presented to the jury. And we agree that the transcript of the civil hearing was not offered as evidence at the criminal trial. Yes?
Yes.
Okay. And at that point, I'm going to cut you off because we are past your time and we'll go on to rebuttal.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. So I'll start with just a couple clarifications about the evidence that were discussed earlier. Exhibit 2, the Register of Actions, notes that a hearing was requested on the restraining order, that harassment hearing was held, does not say anywhere that an order was issued at that hearing or after that hearing.
Counsel, yes. Why? Help me understand why her testimony that the order remained in effect is not enough for the jury to make an inference that there was an active HRO, given these, I think, sort of bizarre circumstances.
So the testimony that's being referred to here, of course, is the alleged victim's testimony, just to be clear, not Ms. Eichler's. But But the reason that that isn't sufficient to prove the state's case is that that whether the HRO was effective or not is a question of law. It's a legal question, and testimony involving legal analysis or questions of law are not of use to the jury and aren't relevant to determining legal questions.
But, so, but I think I think that the testimony is was that was there some order in effect that prevented contact between the two of them, right? And if she says yes, isn't that a matter of fact if the district court maybe on the record said the order is still in effect?
Well, two issues here. First of all, the idea that the district court said on the record that this order, this temporary ex parte order, will continue to remain in effect after the hearing, there are two problems with that. First of all, the statute does not allow that. An HRO is a creature of statute, and the, as has been pointed out many times in this argument, the statute says that temporary ex parte HRO remains effect until a hearing is held on the issuance of the restraining order. So the statute does not allow the court to ignore that language of the statute and purport to extend the effectiveness beyond the date or beyond the hearing being held. The court needed to issue its own order if it was going to do that. And the second thing that has to be recognized here is that this court has already twice rejected the state's attempt to try to get this transcript into the record. This court has denied a motion to supplement the record with this transcript, which did not exist at the time of trial. This court has granted a motion to strike that argument from the state's brief. This court has appropriately recognized in this argument that this decision needs to be based on the evidence that was submitted to the jury at the trial. The evidence that was submitted to the jury at the trial was not and had nothing to do with any oral order that occurred on August 29th. It had to do with the temporary, it was Exhibit 1, the temporary ex parte HRO. And a testimony that occurred at trial that gave an opinion on a legal question of whether that HRO continued to remain in effect is not of help to the trier of fact when you're talking about a legal question. Did this temporary ex parte HRO remain in effect on August 28th? That's a question of law. And if the alleged victim or anyone else erroneously thought that that was true, testimony to that effect isn't helpful to the trier of fact and doesn't resolve the evidentiary issue.
So the distinguishing factor here is the manner in which the question was asked. So if the question were asked, did the district court issue a permanent or an HRO at the orally on the record on August 19th, that would have yielded some other evidence, some different evidence than whether the TRO was extended. That's the argument?
Yes, that would be true. If the alleged victim or any other person had been asked about what happened at the hearing on August 19th, that could potentially be relevant. But of course, that didn't happen, and the state's evidence of the HRO was Exhibits 1 and 2, which was the temporary HRO and the Register of Actions. I'm happy to continue answering questions from the court. I'd be pleased to answer any more if the court has them. Otherwise, I will request this court reverse Ms. Eichler's convictions on the basis in issue one, two, or three. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you, gentlemen, for your arguments and your briefing. The matter has been submitted. You'll have our decision within 90 days. That concludes the court's oral Zoom calendar this morning. We will head towards our deliberation and our non-oral calendar.